Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Huh. Mama, mate, you all right?
Hello, sorry about the delay there. My God, I've just got a screaming daughter downstairs. We just got my wife and I just sorting out, just some childcare today. So the fun of getting old.
Yeah. No, I've got a little one as well, mate, so I understand. It's a bit mental.
It is, isn't it? You sort of like have plans and intentions that everything sort of falls to pieces quite regularly.
Whereabouts are you?
East London.
Okay. I used to live around there. Whereabouts?
Just in Leytonstone, actually. Do you know the area?
Okay. I used to live in like Clapton, Sturt Newington. So not too far away.
We used to live in Dalston, but then, my wife and I, we realised that sort of, we looked around, I think it was around COVID, and we're like, oh, it's such a great area that we're so lucky to live in Hackney. It's like, with all our friends, and then we paused and we were like, all of our friends have left Hackney. What are we still doing?
Yeah, fair play, man. So how old are you? I'm in Manchester.
Oh, nice. Awesome. I am 37. So, clocking on.
Okay. About a couple of years older than me. but always like to, check that. I just like checking out your stuff and like, you've got a hell of a lot going on. And, the first I heard your name was in Gordon Raphael's book. And such an intriguing story about how you started out when you were young, like just interviewing bands. Like, just take us back to that time. Like, how did you get into that?
It's funny thinking back to that. Like, I just started off like anyone, really, just being a music obsessive, a bit of an outcast, a bit of a weirdo at school. Just kind of getting into like a lot of alternative music. And I was about, I think I was 8 years old when I bought Park Life on cassette. And that was quite a sort of turning point. Obviously, I bought a few other cassettes around that era. Like, everyone always cool guys their first tape or CD or whatever. But I also bought two Unlimited, Get Ready and No Limits, which is obviously, spawned that massive Euro hit monster in 1992, I think it was. It was just basically just kind of realizing the counterculture existed at a young age and could be a pop thing as well, and just realizing you could have great pop songs that were also challenging the weird world that we live in. So that kind of got me excited quite young. I also loved writing and reading, and I thought if I just put my love of those things together, then it could be quite cool. And this thing called the internet popped up in the late 90s when I was about, I think what was the first time I went online, I think, was 1997. And I was 12 years old, I want to say, 12. And I just found it so hilarious, this weird beeping noise. And you type something in and then it would take 8 minutes to load a really bad image. And I thought, this is for me. I thought it was really weird and strange and funny. So basically, I started writing about music, I started interviewing artists, and I then started learning how to very basically code a website in 1999. And then in September 2000, after a year of trying to figure out how to move images around and stuff, with my brother, who also helped me, because he was way more techie than me, he really helped put it together. We sort of uploaded this website called Rock Feedback, and Rock Feedback kind of still lives in a form today. It's like a sort of live events business and stuff. But it was like effectively a collection of writing about artists and interviews and all that sort of stuff. And obviously it was quite a weird time to launch a music website in 2000 because the music scene was pretty dog shit, to be honest. I mean, pretty shocking. Britpop had long faded and has had all the amazing heroin albums that followed it, and all the excellent electronic music had died. And so we just had, soft rock and new metal. So, but although the first review that we did publish in 2000 was my friend Tom Hannon, he wrote a review of Kid A by Radiohead. So that was the first album review we put on the website. So that felt like a nice starting of the millennium, if you will.
Yes, and then Well, how would you go about, I mean, you were at some landmark gigs, like Gordon talks about when you went to the Strokes at Heaven, I think.
Yeah.
Like, how would you approach interviewing bands kind of thing?
So basically, yeah, obviously that was in 2001. So the good thing about Rock Feedback Society in 2000 was that it kind of warmed the engines. We sort of uploaded a website. No one cared for ages. It didn't stop me. I just loved writing about music and meeting artists and sort of writing about things. And then, yeah, lo and behold, I did an interview with Jeff Travis, who runs Rough Trade Records for the website, because I also interviewed industry figures because I was just fascinated by how the way the music industry came together as well. And Jeff always kept me posted on Rough Trade releases, you know, so he let me in on about Moldy Peaches, and I did their first UK interview when they landed from New York, still jet lagged. I did it in a pub next to the Barfly, and off the back of that, I then saw that they were announced to open up. They were going to do a whole tour with this band, Strokes, on their first ever UK tour. And obviously, around that period, the Modern Age EP came out. And I remember going down to my local record shop in High Wycombe, a horrible home counties town in Buckinghamshire, and going to the record shop, which was my salvation as a child. It's called Scorpion Records. And for £1, I bought Last Night and the Modern Age on 7-inch, and again, it just blew my mind when I first put it on. I was like, wow, this demo is really raw, like, who the hell recorded this? And of course, you know, as it was spinning around, I saw the name Gordon Raphael as the producer, and so I really clocked it. And the more I listened to it, the more invigorating it felt, because it made me realize everything up to that point for a long time, probably 80s onwards, as a revolt to punk, etc., had been overproduced, and really, like, people got into a habit of overcooking records, and here was this new band from New York who looked cool as hell with amazing songs that weren't trying to do anything other than underproduce their awesomeness. So it was very refreshing. And so obviously I wanted to go and see them, and I couldn't get to the infamous Barfly show they did, but I was able to go to see them in Oxford, which is close to where I grew up, because High Wycombe's between, you know, Oxford and London. And I was able to go to see them in a venue called the Zodiac, which is now the upstairs room at the Academy in Oxford. And I managed to convince Rough Trade to give me an interview with the band. So I went to meet all five of them in a hotel next to the venue. And I just remember just being blown away by the charisma and energy of them as individuals, and their sweetness as well. Because everyone thinks they're morose and droll, but they're actually really sweet, really funny, ultra sharp, obviously. And, you know, they were just very lovely. And I guess in retrospect, you know, I was like 15 or 16. They must have found it quite comedic that this, you know, schoolboy was in this room with a bunch of hungover men laid over beds trying to ask them some questions. And yeah, that was it. Like, off the back of that, they invited me to their Heaven show, which was the night before my philosophy exam. And obviously I took the right decision and I went to the gig. Yeah, like, at the show, it was amazing. It felt seminal, it felt special. You know, it felt like the start of something massive. And after the gig, I managed to find my way into the after show with my dad, who drove me, my wonderful dad, who was very supportive and took me to loads of gigs and turned a blind eye when I was underage drinking. And yeah, like, I was introduced to Gordon Raphael, the band's producer, by Nick Valenci, the guitarist of the band. And Gordon and I, when he was writing his book, we recently had to work out who it was that introduced us. And it took us a while to figure it out, but we remember it was Nick. I think he must have been like, Toby, Gordon, bye. and to this day, Gordon's been a lifelong friend. You know, he came to my wedding, you know, a few years ago, and, you know, we stay in touch very closely, and I love him to bits. He's, you know, he's a wonderful person. He started writing for Rock Feedback off the back of that visit as well.
Yeah, he mentioned that. He said, you know, you asked him pretty much straight away if he'd write for your website, and he was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you've been working with him on his book, like, doing, is it like Q&As, like live Q&As with him?
Yeah. I did a few, like, I did one in Rough Trade for the book launch in London, which was great. I mean, you know, you always worry those things. Like, even like now, it's like, you know, it's interesting to me. You worry what the outside world thinks about your weird life. But, like, you know, it was really nice to get on the stage for an hour and just sort of reminisce and, you know, help tell his incredible story, because he's an absolute outsider to the music industry and hasn't at all played the game and yet has made some of the most seminal modern rock and roll records of our generation and beyond, you know. So, yeah, it was really fun. It was a great event. Lots of awesome people turned up and lots of people from that era as well that just surprise showed themselves in the room. And it was just lovely to sort of, yeah, kind of, you know, reminisce. As I say, like, it's kind of a rarity as well, because, you know, what I and we do now is so forward thinking. So it's nice to occasionally, you know, look back and be nostalgic and embarrassing before you move forward again.
Yeah, you're saying like you reminded him of quite a few stories, like one about Johnny Burrell reading poetry at some kitchen party or something.
Yeah, it's a shame because I was going to save that for my book. But yeah, I mean, like, yeah, like, it's just, I don't know, like, Johnny was always a very sweet person, and I'm sure still is. And but yeah, there was this, you know, I have to be honest, you know, there was this quite unusual time where Gordon had this like house called Regent House in Islington, and it was just full of, like, you know, dropouts, bohos, delinquents. It was fantastic. You know, there was all sorts of weird shit going on, and it all felt a bit wrong in a good way. So I felt very fortunate to be privy and invited to these gatherings at the age of, I think I must have been like 17. And just, you know, when you're that age, you're impressionable and you're bored at school and you just want to grow up faster and all that sort of stuff. And so being around all these, you know, terribly behaved adults was excellent. And yeah, we were just like listening to records and having drinks and just sitting around and thinking about stuff. And Gordon had set up his Moog synthesizer collection in his bedroom in this massive, almost like courtyard layout. And you could just sort of like go from left to right and make these very cosmic oscillations. That kind of gives you an insight to where our brains were at during those parties. But I remember one time it was like, it was really like loud pumping music downstairs, people kind of dancing and chatting. And then suddenly this guy just goes up to the stereo and they just very slowly sort of turns it down. And everyone's just like, okay, what's this? Maybe he's going to change the record or start DJing. And he basically just introduced himself very, very cavalier way and just read some poems. And in essence, I don't have any problem with that. You know, the context of, you know, being around in a creative household and art and all this sort of stuff, it was interesting, but it just felt fucking inappropriate and a bit strange. And everyone afterwards didn't know what to say or do. And then suddenly someone just went up behind him. They just slowly turned the stereo back up as if it never happened. And it was Johnny Burrell that did that. That did happen.
And I mean, you were a great age for things like the Libertines kicking off. Like, how excited were you personally at that time about the likes of them?
Oh, amazing. You know, like, I mean, obviously the Strokes of 2001, that year was extraordinary, obviously, as we talked about. And then, yeah, literally a year later, you know, yeah, the Libertines arrived. And obviously they've been sort of bubbling under for a couple of years prior to that. But, you know, they were kind of a bit more of a sort of acoustic-y, softer version of what they became. And I think they obviously were very more than inspired. I think they just saw an opportunity. They were like, we're writing melodic songs, let's put them through a noisier guitar pedal, let's get, you know, let's add some gain and let's put some leather jackets on, you know. And you know, that was, it sounds a bit trite and a bit basic, but people forget that with music and art, like, it's fashion. And, you know, fashion is like this brilliant seasonal thing. And you know, it can lead to incredible temporary innovation and temporary reboots of how we think and see the world. And that was what was exciting about the Strokes, did they completely cattle prodded the inertia of musicians into being more exciting. And I think the Libertines were always going to be incredibly successful and talented, because between Carl and Pete, you've got two incredible individuals as people, but also writers. And so you put that together and the chemistry was obviously undeniable. And again, via the Rough Trade connection, Jeff Travis launched this new club night called Rough Night at Cherry Jam in West London. And he said, you should come down. We've got this brand new signing that are going to headline called the Libertines. And it's their first proper gig since they've signed to the label and stuff. And I went down. Gordon was, of course, there. Gordon and I hadn't contacted before to sort of coordinate plans. So I was like, ah, oh, this is a good sign. And And yeah, they just went on stage and they were slightly out of time and, you know, they knocked the mic stands over and they kind of got the words wrong and it was messy. But again, it was fucking brilliant. You could tell the songs were amazing. They basically played the bulk of the first album. And yeah, I just remember becoming obsessed. And I, at that point, probably every week, if not every other week, I'd see the Libertines live for the next 2 years in London, you know. Even when they became a Brixton band or an arena band, they would always play the Barfly or Rhythm Factory or 333 Club in Shoreditch at the time. You know, they would just always pop up everywhere and it created a community. You made friends and you got wankered and you had fun.
And were you able to interview them, like, on occasions kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I basically was very lucky to do their first interview, actually. Like, they had an Enemy interview lined up on May Day, because they had a song called May Day. I'm sure lots of people listening will remember. So Enemy had May Day, so I knew that as that was their day, I had to get the interview before then. So I went to see them in Oxford again. They were playing with the Vines, who I had an interview booked with, which was quite a weird experience, but wonderful at the same time. And I managed to convince Pete and Carl and their management at the time, this amazing sort of guru manager, Banny, that I should do the first interview for Rock Feedback. The way I pitched it, I think, was that they need interview experience. They should warm up for their Enemy one by doing a Rock Feedback interview first. and at that point, I left it out of the original article because I felt like I couldn't tell if it was conjecture and I didn't want to get anyone in hot water. But they told me during that interview, and it's now since come out, that they were also at that Heaven gig that I met Gordon at, and they were actually selling the band Acid, I think it was. So all roads lead to that Heaven London gig. The Libertines were in the corner whilst I was meeting Gordon for the first time, whilst the Strokes were, you know, having their first moment. So yeah, it's kind of mad when you think about it like that.
Yeah. And, you know, I said in the build up to the interview, you could think of some like memorable interviews. Obviously, it's a bit of a who's who of back in the day, really. But are there any that stand out? Like you mentioned, the Vines was a bit of a mad one.
I think the Vines one was just only mad because I think that Craig, the singer, had just done like five quite strong bong hits before we hit record. So I just think he wasn't necessarily in the most lucid space for the first 5 minutes at least, but he quickly regained ground. I have to say it's quite impressive. But like, I don't know, all of it's amazing. You know, at the time it feels special and ceremonious, and then you look back at it with the benefit of time and you do realize it was an amazing era of music, you know, like the Strokes, as I say, were so wide-eyed and naive. There was none of the darkness that set in through their sudden rise a couple of years later. They were just optimistic, and I think that's the word that I'll probably use for that era. Like, you know, we felt it a bit in the 90s with Britpop, you know, but in the noughties, you know, as much as Vice wanted to kind of try and create a malaise and a sort of negative spin on that era, despite doing very well within that scene. You know, the reality is that it was optimistic and it was positive and people helped each other out and people made friends and people met their future partners, both business and personal. And, you know, those scenes, unfortunately, those communities aren't quite as rife as they were. And when people go, oh, that's nostalgia, it's just practical. Like back then, there were club nights every night of the week in London. There aren't now. There just aren't. And every time I meet someone working in the music industry, my first thing is like, start a club night, create a community. Like that's how you're going to meet people. That's how you're going to learn. That's how you're going to have fun. You know, like the music industry shouldn't be this like serious thing all the time. Sometimes it's just about meeting people, creating ideas and just, you know, having fun, and then that leads to great work, you know. And so that's what it felt like back then, and the interviews reflected that. It was just lots of people that were very ambitious, that were having a great time and just wanted to do some cool stuff, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, did you interview the White Stripes? I'm right in thinking that.
So I didn't interview the White Stripes. I interviewed Jack White as part of the Raconteurs.
Okay.
And that's from my, so basically all of these early website things, I ended up starting to do a club night as well called The Basement Club with Gordon. So we started, when I started the website, it was like 2 years before we started that club night, and we had loads of, you know, put on the first shows from people like the Libertines, Block Party, the Zootons, and the Thrills, and the Future Heads, and the Maccabees, you know, like loads of the transgressive roster before we started the label, like Foles and Noisettes, and we also had Jamie T. So we had that club right for 6 years in London. And then I started thinking it would be quite cool to transport that amazing energy and that excitement and the interviews to TV. And so I made a TV show called Rock Feedback TV, which went on MTV and Channel 4. And basically that's where I interviewed Jack White. I managed to sort of go to Fuji Rock in Japan. That was the whole thing. We just wanted to go to cool places and then legitimize it as being a TV program. And that was where I first interviewed Jack White, which was amazing. He was, again, super charming and really sharp and damn funny, and didn't crack a smile when he was cracking lots of brilliant dark jokes. That was the thing. But all of these artists, they just emerged so quickly. It's almost like everyone was just like silently around the world doing cool stuff, and then it just needed this zeitgeist moment to come together and give everyone the power to become known, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, starting a TV show, it's no mean feat. Like, how are we making these things happen? Was it just a case of, like you said, this community where you just be meeting people all the time and have opportunities?
Yeah, like, so I actually met someone via Gordon who was like doing some filming stuff, and I was already like kind of planning out how we could do some film stuff, because I basically was really keen to like kind of, yeah, just put these interviews in visual form basically. And it was all before YouTube, which makes me sound even older now. So at the time, MTV2 was like the channel, you know, for all of these artists, you know, all the videos from The Strokes, The White Stripes, you name it, was premiered on MTV2. So even though it didn't have the biggest reach, it was very influential. So the dream for me was like to get onto MTV2. And I did work experience at XFM, which is now called Radio X, obviously. And there at the time was the DJ Zane Lowe. And I met Zane whilst he was working as the afternoon drive time DJ. And he was really supportive. He just said, look, Toby, you know, you're doing some cool stuff with the website that you're doing. If you ever want a hand in stuff, just let me know. So I called him that favor 2 years later when I basically... from some of the money I made from the club nights I was putting on with Gordon, I've saved up enough money after a year to go to New York, because obviously it felt like that's where it was all happening. And I knew Gordon was making Room on Fire at the time with The Strokes as well. So I thought maybe if I turn up the camera, I might be able to get some action there. That didn't happen, but it was good to be there. And I just shot a pilot basically with a lot of artists like Broken Social Scene, Feist, Jet, Regina Spektor, some really amazing artists whilst I was there in that week in New York. And I basically compiled this sort of little tape of me chatting to people backstage with some live performance footage. And I showed that to Zane when I got back, and, you know, I think he was very supportive. You know, he just thought it was quite raw, it was gritty. I was trying to do something quite anti-polish really to what was going on. Yeah, he then took that to MTV2, and then they commissioned 6 shows of it, basically. And then that went on to Channel 4 for another 6 series over the next 5 years. So that was kind of how I got into TV and film, basically. But yeah, it was pretty cool.
Oh, amazing. Can you watch that anywhere now? Do you have like a YouTube channel or anything?
You know what? You can't, sadly. But I do have an archive, and I'm kind of thinking about what to do with it, because we've got some amazing footage, you know, like, you know, everyone from, like, as I mentioned, that Jack White thing through to all the early Libertine stuff. And yeah, there's loads of footage, and it spans like the best part of that decade, the decade we're talking about, basically. So I kind of think it'd be cool to try and figure out how to digitize it and get it up somewhere, and if not, come up with a bigger story for it. So yeah, that's something I'm thinking about at the moment, basically.
That'd be amazing, yeah, because someone's mentioned that to me recently, like the whole meet me in the bathroom thing. Like,
yes,
it is crying out for a UK version, isn't it, really?
I think so. I mean, you know, America and the UK have just always had this incredible, like, relationship. You know, one sort of spits something out amazing, and then the other one responds, and it's this incredible sort of tennis match of brilliance. And, you know, I agree. I think America fired the first gun with The Strokes and the whole meet me in the bathroom scene, as it were. And, you know, the UK has ever since, you know, kind of been consistently, you know, exciting and interesting as well. So, yeah, I think it'd be great. And also, as I say, because a lot of this was pre-YouTube, a lot of this stuff doesn't exist on there, you know. So if it, a lot of this is coming from people's memories. And also camera phones were absolutely shit back then. So photos are terrible. So part of me wonders if it even happened.
Yeah, just watch the footage back and be like, oh, right, that's what happened.
Yeah, totally. It's going to be helpful.
Yeah, working at XFM sounds exciting. Did you ever meet Carl Pilkington by any chance?
I didn't meet Carl, unfortunately, no, which is a legend. But I did get given away as a prize on The Breakfast Show. That happened. Right. I did get sort of on-air proposition by Ricky Gervais to stay under the desk and look after him during his programs, which was a bit of a strange proposition. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was an interesting era.
Yeah. Then you mentioned transgressive, like, I mean, how does that work? I mean, as an outsider, like, can you explain how, you know, you started that and what the intentions were of it to start with?
Yeah, I mean, so one of those club nights that I was doing with Gordon, which was called the Basement Club, like, which year was it? I want to say it was September 2003. Yes, September 2003. I think that might have been the first time we put Block Party on. And I'd heard about them because super randomly my dad, who, you know, loves music but wasn't involved in the industry and just was very supportive of what I was up to, he was reading one of the NMEs that I just lay open, and he came up with this mad idea, which in retrospect was utter genius. He said, where the live adverts are, where people are looking for musicians and other people to join their bands, what happens if you just read one of those descriptions to see if one of these bands could become something interesting? And I was like, yeah, Dad, whatever. I was just there typing away, like a reviewer or whatever. And anyway, he decided to take it upon himself. He saw this one advert where someone said their influences were Joy Division, Gang of Four and The Cure, and they were looking for a drummer. And it said, contact Kelly at this number. And so my dad contacted Kelly, not as a drummer, but just purely on blind speculation that this band might become something. Anyway, that band was called The Angel Range, and they invited us to their first ever gig when they found a drummer. So my dad and I went, and it was Block Party before they found Matt to play drums. And we went to the show at The Verge, which is in Kentish Town, and the person promoting that show was Tim. And Tim is basically the guy that a year later really meet at a club night where I was putting on Block Party, and Kelly would introduce us properly from the band, so you guys should know each other. And Tim was basically selling their 7-inch, their debut single, She's Hearing Voices, and I was putting on their show. And that was a meeting of minds. And then within 3 weeks, Tim and I met up again, and we decided to start a record label. That label is Transgressive. And really, the whole scene that we're talking about was like this incredible propeller for, you know, lots of projects and meeting of minds. And as soon as I met Tim, I just felt we were, you know, firstly, we were just like making each other laugh a lot, trying to offend each other more than the other person was. And then the other thing was, we were talking about quite obscure records, you know, and realizing at the age of 19, which we were at the time, that a lot of our friends didn't necessarily know these records. And I think that was a real meeting ground of like minds, you know. So it made us feel excited to try and do something together. And as of last month, it's been 18 years since Transgressive's been existing. So yeah, it's been pretty wild.
Yeah, that's amazing. And like, how would you make it work financially? Did you have any backing, or was it just kind of seeing how it goes kind of thing?
Yeah, it had £1,000, 500 of which came from Tim's student loan and a loan from his dad. And that was it. That's all we had. I had no money at all. And, you know, we just thought the logic would be, we have £1,000. We can make a 500 run of a limited edition 7-inch single. And if it sold out, we could fund another one. That was how the business model worked. And if there was like £100 left over, great, you know, and then we'd just leave that in a pool, as it were, for future investments. And then, yeah, we managed to get through that model, that precarious model, five times over, where our first 5 7-inch singles sold out. And it included people like the Mystery Jets and Subways and great bands like that. And after a few of these singles and the club nights and the website I was doing and the fanzine Tim was doing, it kind of like this little mini ecosystem that we created together sort of caught the attention of people that did have money. And they basically all got in touch and offered us distribution deals and stuff. And we ended up agreeing terms with Warner's, where they said we could keep our 100% independence, but they would fund and market and distribute our records around the world. And off the back of that, we, you know, the first album we released was Regina Spektor, who I'd met via Gordon, who produced the Soviet Kitcher third record. So we signed Regina Spektor, that's the first album that came out in Transgressive. And then shortly afterwards, we signed The Young Knives, which is the first record Tim and I A&R'd, which was produced by the late, great Andy Gill of Gang of Four. And that got Mercury nominated. So to sort of A&R a record for the first time without any experience and for it to get a Mercury nomination blew Tim and I away. It made us feel really sort of excited that we were on something. And then another Oxford band that we were hooked up with that Tim knew for a while and that came from that scene was then Foals, who we signed to the label. And we then also managed to license The Shins and Iron and Wine into Transgressive in that period and release some other great bands from the time as well. And that was kind of the first 3 or 4 years of the label, basically. So we were very lucky that we sort of sold out those 7-inch singles, were able to start making records, and then thankfully those records did well enough to keep it going, you know.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If noughties guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Noughties Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Noughties Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. That moment where Warner step in, is that like the equivalent of a band getting signed, really? At that point, you're thinking, right, we've hit a landmark here, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like, and I think the reason we did it with them, you know, A, they gave us 100% independence, so we still kept the company. They didn't want any equity in Transgressive. Called a Marshall, who did the deal. We just really liked him. He was hilarious. Like, he'd started an independent label, Infectious, and he was an indie guy that was hiding in a major, basically, at the time. And it felt like he had sort of, I don't know, he felt like one of us that had just got the keys to the castle. So it felt like an inside job of sorts. So he also just said, look, you've probably met a lot of people here in Kensington, because they were all based in posh offices in Kensington at the time. Probably met a lot of people here that are telling you what to do and they're going to own your company. And we were like, yep. And they was like, we're not going to do that. You know, we trust you. Go ahead and do it and make a mess. And that's what we did with his blessing. But yeah, it felt like, I mean, that was the first time that I was able to take salary from music. By that point, I'd been working for 6 years, and apart from the occasional money to pay my phone bill from the club night, really it was all free. I was self-exploiting to sort of kind of just, I don't know, be involved in this music thing and hope that it would one day make sense. And thankfully that's when it did start to make sense, you know, like when we started the label, and then a year later we did that distribution deal. And then yeah. And then thankfully ever since it's been my job. So I've been very lucky for that.
Yeah, quality. And did you have, you know, you mentioned Gordon, was there other people he kind of leaned on? I don't know, like people like Alan McGee who were around that scene for like advice on how to go about things?
Well, for me personally?
Yeah, just if there was any, you know, obviously very young at the time still, I just wondered if there were any kind of odd, almost mentor figures maybe that you had.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Jeff Travers was really supportive. Alan McGee was also supportive as well. You know, I did an early interview with him for the website. Steve Lamack was super supportive. You know, I sent him an email just before I even started the website, and he gave me some amazing email advice just about you know, what kind of characters to sort of look out for in the music industry and what kind of company to keep, you know, and that advice was really greatly appreciated and made more sense as the years went on, actually, about making sure that you stay on the pure side of the music industry and not the version that is solely trying to turn a profit, because there is that side of it, like any industry, there's good and bad, and you just have to make sure you stay close to people that are in it for the right reasons, really, and who have kept that sense of honesty and purity in their work. So Steve Lamacq was really influential. Claire Sturgis, when she was at XFM, she was a massive supporter. Kathy St. Luce, who used to be the PR for loads of amazing artists like Radiohead and stuff like that. When no one else was sending me CDs in 1999 and 2000, she was happy to send these CDs off to this kid in High Wycombe. And she was an amazing inspiration. She's an incredible person. And then, yeah, like in America, the first American mentor was Seymour Stein, who started Sire Records, which is one of Tim and my favourite labels of all time. You know, Sire signed the Ramones and Madonna and the Talking Heads and licensed the Cure and the Smiths to America. And lo and behold, this legendary guy that Belle and Sebastian wrote a song after was giving Tim and me advice and $250 lobster plates that neither of us could read because we were too young and scared of what was in front of us. But yeah, it was just like these amazing experiences and huge characters, you know, and to be introduced to this weird world of music was such an honor from all these people and several others as well, you know, just so much fun.
Yeah, yeah. And then in terms of, you know, the bands that you try and work with, was it quite easy to get them to buy into what you're doing, like with you being completely independent and stuff?
Well, these days or back then?
Sorry, yeah, back then, were you kind of, did you have an advantage in the fact you're more personable than other labels kind of thing?
I don't know, you'd probably have to ask them, I guess, but like, I guess the one thing that was good about talking to us, potentially, if you're an artist, and hopefully still the same now, is that you're talking to the people that run the company and who love the company and aren't going anywhere else. Do you know what I mean? And I think sometimes in music, you know, there's a lot of competition to sign great artists, which is amazing and really healthy for the artists and the industry. But, you know, I think if you're an artist, maybe some of those people have been in quite a lot of places before, which isn't a problem. Everyone's journey is different and that's cool. But like, I guess if you want a sense of security that you want to be in the same place for a while and create that community, then we're probably hopefully a reassuring option, you know, like even though it's like quite a cool name and brand and we've worked with a lot of auteurs and stuff, like at the heart of it, we're, you know, we're quite traditional as people and we're quite old school and we just want, you know, we want to create long lasting relationships and, you know, we believe in integrity and decent ethics and respecting people and being kind and quite a lot of simple things that sometimes don't always apply in the music industry, even though they should as a standard. So I think hopefully if people sit down with us and, you know, we're mutually thinking we're good partners for each other, hopefully they'll just see that, you know, we're doing it because we love it. We're not doing it because we're just here to make money, you know. Yeah, we kind of feel like we're on a quest, you know. We feel like we're here to do something cool for the world and for ourselves and for the artists we work with and the audiences that love music. And it feels like an opportunity, so we're going to fucking go for it, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And then in terms of deciding, you know, or staying on like the cutting edge type of things with the music, obviously, like you say, that idea from your dad is genius. Like, you get in the band before they're even fully formed. was that an approach you carried on taking?
You know what, like I haven't actually, and the reason for that is that, you know, my dad, I think he was retired at that point, so he's a bit of an older guy, so he had the time and the bandwidth to like just do that research, and it paid off in that instance. And you know, just in terms of like, when I say paid off, it's not like we ended up professionally linked to the band in a financial way. We did a couple of singles and shows, but that was it. But more just paid off in terms of that time and that curiosity was paid off with a brilliant band and us being lucky to see them at the beginning all the way through. And you're right, I think as a philosophy, that's probably a good way to do it. But it does require time, you know, checking in on people and seeing if they did get the drummer, what happened to the last drummer they fired, seeing them at the Hope and Anchor again, you know, and that stuff's cool. But like, obviously, you know, our loyalties also have to be to the artists that we've signed and got on the roster. And so unfortunately that time and commitment isn't quite there, but I would recommend it as a strategy. I think it's a bold move, and it might be a needle in a haystack sometimes, but it was definitely a nice way of doing it.
Yeah. But what was your approach to finding new bands then, really, back in the day?
At the time, I think it's kind of similar to now, really. Like, a lot of it is you listen to as much as you can. Obviously, you never, unfortunately, get through to everything you want to listen to because of time and hours in the day and, say, the existing roster, which has to take precedence. Yeah, like, you listen to as much as you can. You listen to people. Like, you know, sometimes you'll just be in a random place, some not in the music world, some not in the industry at all, and they'll just go, I've heard of this amazing person that's really good at this. And you just always have to keep an open mind. I think that's the most important thing about music and the industry, is always keeping a pure perspective, always believing that anything great can happen and come from anywhere. And I think if you lose that, then you're forgetting the basis of art and how talent sort of, you know, kind of finds itself to art, and also realizing that people change and develop. There are some artists that I heard in the early days that I didn't necessarily see eye to eye with musically, but then a year or two later their skills formed, or I caught up, or a combination of the two, and then before you know it, you become a huge fan. So, you know, it's just about keeping an open mind at the beginning and the middle of the journey for an artist. So and also I think like attracts like, you know, listen to your bands as well. A lot of the artists we work with have said, you should check this artist out. And, you know, certainly Johnny Flynn, who we manage and have worked with for a long time now, you know, he said, you should check out Marika Hackman. And we ended up signing her to management and publishing. And you know, like things like that, you know, it's kind of a very, I don't know, I feel there's a law of attraction, really, with the way it all works. And also, thankfully now, you know, not at the beginning, obviously, because it's brand new, but like now Transgressive has got a bit of a reputation for certain, you know, types of music and certain types of approaches with artists and certain ideologies. And that also helps attract the right people, you know. You know, like if someone had told me that, you know, we'd be signing Damon Albarn, you know, like a year ago, I would have been like, what planet are you on? But that's what happens. You know, you kind of you get to those lofty places because of hopefully doing good work and just staying consistent and just putting the time in and trying to be as decent and ethical and principled as you can and not let, you know, the noise of the world get in the way of that, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, I always like to ask people how they think things have changed. Like obviously the 2000s was like maybe the last era where a lot of money was getting thrown about. And, you know, it's like to see how it's different for bands now. Like, how do you think it's changed for new bands these days compared to the 2000s?
Good question. I mean, I think it's always been hard. And what I mean by that is that I think it's really expensive, challenging, time commitment for artists to sort of meet the right people, get the instruments assembled or the software or the hardware assembled, and then basically sort of commit to being a musician alongside whatever obligations exist in your life at that time, whether you're at school or uni or you've got a job or multiple jobs or a family or whatever it is or whatever obligations. I feel like that is all hard, you know, and I commend anyone that commits to it in that way. And Tim and I do have firsthand experience of, you know, committing to music projects. And so we empathize and know that process as well. And then on top of that, from the industry side of it, I think it is, it's, I'd say because of what's going on the last 2.5 years, particularly like COVID onwards, like it is a really tough era. I think, you know, live is more expensive and challenging than ever, like to get in and out of countries. Even artists we work with getting into the UK that aren't from the UK is harder than it's ever been, which is really sad and disappointing. So I do think it's tough. I think the costs are really exponentially higher than they were to do some of these things. And the returns aren't quite what they were either proportionally. So yeah, I think it is a bit harder at the moment. I hate to say than it was maybe back then. I think you had the challenges of just forming a band, as I mentioned, or getting your music project together. That's the tough part, really, and making it great. And then the next tough part is getting it out to the world and getting it to the industry. And, you know, it wasn't easy back then to do those things. You still had to work really hard, but maybe there was a bit more freedom of movement, and maybe the costs weren't so proportionally high to do so. And also, dare I say, maybe there was a scene element back then that could propel you a bit faster. I think now there isn't a scene element, and I think every artist is a bit more individualistic because of the way that the streaming models work. So, you know, for every helpful algorithm that sort of tells you a related artist or your next favorite artist, which can help blow up your profile, there's also the sense you have to build up your own kind of iceberg for every project, you know, your own followers, your own audience, your own stream count, your own sales, your own tours. It feels a bit less connected than it was in the noughties, I'd say. So those are challenges for sure. But the upside is that I think art and music has never been more readily available before, you know, like, and I think people can discover your music from their phone, whereas back then it had to be a record shop or the NME or some other media gatekeeper. You know, there is a bit more autonomy on the you know, the artist as well as the and the audience. You know, like, an audience can create a hit now a lot faster than the industry can, and I think that's a power balance shift. So for every sort of like downside, I can see a lot of progress as well in the current age. And I'm definitely not going to be nostalgic for how the music industry became towards the end of that decade either, because, you know, piracy killed record sales, and you know, and really artists weren't getting remunerated. Record labels didn't have enough money to invest in new talent. So everything went down, you know, in 2008 to 2011, as it did across many industries. So what's happened subsequently with the advent of streaming, even though there's a lot of problems and the value model is yet to be corrected as it should be, it's definitely, even if it, some people might see it differently, it's definitely better in a lot of other ways, you know. And there are a lot of other artists now that are able to propel themselves from their bedroom in a way that they couldn't all that time ago. They would need more money, more investment, more infrastructure to try and get them an audience. And I think that has changed now.
Yeah, you mentioned like things being corrected in terms of money. Do you think that will happen in terms of streaming and stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like, I mean, I think Apple have just announced, obviously, they're putting their subscription rate up, you know, so that'll be, you know, I think it's gone up 10%. So that's going to be more money that's going to come to rights holders slash artists. So, you know, I think that that's going to be a really positive step in, you know, being able to keep investing in new artists and keep building things. So hopefully other streaming companies might consider that as well. I don't know. It depends on how that all works. But it's definitely a step in the right direction, because I don't know what you think, but I kind of feel like £10 a month is quite a good deal, because I used to spend, well, I still do because I buy loads of vinyl, but like I spend way more than 10 quid a month on records and CDs or whatever growing up, you know. But if you don't buy physical products, then, you know, 10 quid a month is not a bad, £11 a month isn't a bad deal, is it, for every song in the world?
No, exactly. It's crazy when you think about it. And like,
it's crazy.
You don't even have to pay anything if you're willing to listen to adverts, pretty much.
Yeah, that's another part. Yeah, that's very true, which is how probably most people in the world listen to stuff. I mean, yeah, but I think it will get corrected. I'm optimistic that it will, because, you know, I think it's still relatively nascent, you know, this technology and this distribution method, and there's still a lot of people learning about how to subscribe to these platforms. So I think it will get better. And I think also as well, you know, like, there are challenges for artists, but I think people do need to remember there are more artists making music than ever now. So that there's that attention side of things as well. And people weren't necessarily making loads of money in the 90s or noughties from music as well. I think a lot of people have this very rose-tinged memory, but there weren't as many artists back then. So it was easier for fewer to make more. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
How many artists can you think of from the 90s and the early 2000s that exist now that are still very prevalent? You know, there aren't loads of artists from the second half of that decade onwards to now that are either still going or making what those artists were, you know? So I think there's a bit of a sort of misalignment there sometimes when people talk about.
Yeah, do you think it is a bit rose-tinted when people look back and think, you know, there was a bigger wealth of guitar bands back then?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you have to ask people like Sam Fender and Yard Act and Arctic Monkeys and loads of artists that were either performed in the last 5 years or longer, you know, how they feel about their careers. And like, I don't know. I mean, I was at Reading and Leeds again this year, and as much as there were all genres of music, there were shit tons of guitar bands playing to a lot of people. I just think it's more diverse. Dare I say that's a better thing? Like, you know, as much as I love the noughties and I love guitar music, everyone was sick of it by the end of it. You can hear it in the music. People are like bored writing these second and third albums that they knew themselves weren't of any consequence. You know, not everyone could be Arctic Monkeys, not everyone could be The Strokes, not everyone could be Jack White, not everyone could be the AAS. Like, that's the sad reality. You know, the people that were those artists are kind of the originators, and they're the ones that had the long-term vision and they had the chops, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of great artists that existed in that time, but you know, there's nothing wrong with something being temporary. Why should scenes last forever? Do you know what I mean? That's a weird placement, you know. I think it's just lucky if things happen at all in the first place, do you know what I mean? And then if you keep working to innovate and learn and grow, then you may not do that thing forever. You might go into something even better than what you originated from, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I just want to make sure
what do you think about that sentiment as well? I'm just curious to get your take on that as someone that's speaking to a lot of people about this era specifically.
Yeah, so that was like a big reason for doing the podcast. It was like me and my friends did feel nostalgic about that period. So I was like, I'll try and dig in and find out whether we're just being, yeah, nostalgic about it. And I think just the way people find music now has changed. Like, because it was so defined back in the day, like talking to people at the Cribs, that's what they were saying. It's like, you know, you'd have your Enemy, MTV2. Yeah. Zane Lowe was a big one for me on radio. Whereas now it's kind of, it's not as defined as that. But I do find if I listen to the likes of Mark Riley on Six Music, I'll hear two or three great bands in one show. But it's just a case of, I don't have that same dedication I used to, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's a good acknowledgement on your part, because people forget with nostalgia, it's also the amount of information you're willing to take in at that point. You know, as you get older, like, your brain gets filled with horseshit of like every variety. You could become more politically interested when you couldn't care when you're like 18 to 25. You don't care. Like, and that's a big problem in itself, unfortunately. And I think the next generation that's coming up, seemingly, as a media generalization at least, seems to be a bit more actively engaged, which is helpful. But certainly our generation did not care. Like, if you listen to the noughties, it was the least politically aware, interested set of music. It was just about nights out and parties and, you know, like growing up disgracefully, and that was why it was exciting. And then you get older, you have a family, and you know your brain fills up with the news and the challenges of the world and responsibilities and paying the bills and all this stuff. And yeah, of course guitar music's not going to be top of that list, is it? It just can't be. but you know, it's good that it was at some point. That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, a good example is a band you work with now, Always.
Yes.
I remember listening, that was just one of the random days I was listening to Six Music, and I was like, it was Archie, Marry Me, the song. And I was like, wow, this is this. So that's like, that sticks out as like one of those bands where if you do, you know, put a bit of time in, you're going to get a great band like that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's an interesting reference, that band, because when we first heard and saw them, exactly as you described, we heard that song, we heard the bulk of the first record, and we were like, oh my God, it felt fresh. So we were like, this is definitely of our time. But it also felt knowingly nostalgic, you know, teenage fan club and fuzzy guitars and Dinosaur Jr. and all sorts of incredible reference points. And loads of British bands as well that they're hugely inspired by. And yeah, it was, I'm not gonna lie, it's a bit of a comfort blanket, you know, that band. And they know that, you know, they love Britpop. Like, if you speak to Molly and Alec about, they can talk about Blur and Oasis for hours. It's like B-sides, you know, really get deep. But they also are smart enough, in the same way the Strokes have, you know, that aesthetic, Strokes have that sort of retro future vibe where it's like the 70s, but with like this kind of 70s portrayal of the future, always have that technical thing as well, where the production flicks between hi-fi and lo-fi, and the visuals are slightly sort of grainy and, you know, like kind of referencing like a past era, but then also feel very much, you know, our current time. And I think that's what's been interesting about streaming, is that I think we're homogenizing decades into one new era. Like, we're pulling together 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties, current era into one thing. And that's something that smart bands can do now. They can really blur the boundaries of what scene they're pulling from. And I think in doing that, they're creating something quite fresh and exciting with the hallmarks of what inspired them, you know. And I think a lot of those, you know, the new guitar bands for the last 5 years, you know, whether it is like Yard Act and all these great bands, it's like, you know, there's this sense of, you know, they're kind of like re-updating post-punk and all those progressive scenes, and just doing something that feels very of its time because of the social political challenges we have right now. So yeah, I think it's cool. I think it's good when people pull together the past and the present, but as long as it's not solely regressive and looking backwards, then I think it's a good thing, you know.
Yeah. Cheers for your time there. I'll just ask you a couple more. I just wanted to mention, I saw, are you working on the Liam Gallagher Nebworth film?
Yes.
Right. I mean, yeah, what's your involvement with that, and how exciting has that been?
Yeah, well, like, as I mentioned, because of the TV stuff that I did a while ago, I sort of, when I stopped doing the Rock Feedback sort of episodes for Channel 4 and MTV, I basically started doing like kind of longer form documentary stuff periodically every few years sort of thing. And I did something, the first one of those projects was hilariously with Rihanna in, what year was it? I can't remember. It's probably about 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, around her album Unapologetic. And so that came out like as a sort of longer film thing. And it was a cool project, but there were some issues with the way that, you know, post-production was run, and I was learning on my feet, and I was only 26 and all this sort of stuff. So, but I loved the experience of trying to make a longer form film. After doing a few more like over the years, like basically I saw that obviously the Nebworth show was happening, and I just thought it'd be really cool to sort of document. Imagine being an artist that was big enough to have that Oasis moment as Liam, but to go back as a solo artist and then sell out 170,000 tickets as a solo artist. I just thought it was such an amazing story. And so I managed to just like put together this sort of creative treatment, and I sent it to his team, and they fortunately liked it, and Liam liked the idea of it. And yeah, I met up with him a few weeks before Nebworth. We just started rolling this documentary. So this documentary comes out in cinemas next month, and it's going to go out on Paramount Plus, the streaming channel, in December. But yeah, it's been quite a trip.
Amazing, yeah. I used to ask people quite a lot, like if they had any Liam Gallagher stories. So obviously you'd find a few funny ones back in the day. Like you said, with the likes of, you mentioned Block Party, they had like some words back in the day. But yeah, what's he like to deal with on like a one-to-one basis?
I think, you know, I think probably like a lot of musicians that come from that era, like I think he's probably mellowed out quite a lot. Do you know what I mean? Because on the one hand, you do get the full-blown, you know, assault. Like I just had to do something for our subtitle team. We had to go through the amount of swearing and stuff because we're getting the film classified at the moment. And, you know, it is easily, I don't think I'll ever work on a project with as much, strong language ever again. I'm partial to swearing, but it is remarkable. Even the first 2 minutes is just, it's impressive more than anything. But he's, you know, he's actually one of the funniest people you could meet, like genuinely. Like when we were doing the interviews, I had to really hold it in, like, you know, when he was saying certain comments, because he says everything with a complete deadpan straight face, and he'll say the most outrageous shit you can imagine, and it's really funny. And you obviously, because you're recording it for the film, I can't laugh because it will cut across his answers and stuff. So I found myself often like having to look in the opposite direction of the microphone and just like quietly let out this laughter whilst he was just saying some mad stuff. But like, yeah, he's really entertaining. He's really funny. He's actually quite a sweet person as well. He probably wouldn't want anyone to hear that. And he really cares about his fans, like in a way that I found really moving, actually. He cares about the audience, and he's on a level with the way things are for people at the moment in this country and in this time that we live in. So yeah, I have the utmost of respect for him. And it was a really fun, mad project to work on. You know, we had 20 cameras set up at Nebworth, and it was like a huge production. So it was just, yeah, it was just really cool to pull it together, really, with an amazingly talented team of people. It was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, so I look forward to watching that, definitely. And then I always like to finish on whether people would do anything differently about their career. Like when I spoke to Alan McGee, he said that not signing The Darkness was maybe a big one for him.
Amazing. Well,
he said he had the chance to, and he said like he just couldn't take them seriously at the time, but maybe he said he should have done it. But just wondered if you had any moments like that. Is there any bands that kind of got away from you?
Oh yeah, loads. I mean, you know, it just happens because, you know, it's just there's so much incredible music out there, you can't work with it all, and there's loads of artists that you want to sign that for whatever reason over the years it just sort of either comes together or it doesn't. And there's this Japanese artist, Cornelius, who Tim and I are just the biggest fans of, and Lila as well, you know, and we just basically, we were offered to put out the album Sensuous, which came out like probably about 14, 15 years ago. And it's just a really influential, brilliant electronic record. But at the time, I don't know, I think we were just very actively engaged in what we were doing and we couldn't find the bandwidth. But it's a super amazing album. And he just recently actually returned to the stage. He played Fuji Rock this summer and Foles all went to see him, and they were all just messaging saying it was like the best show they've ever seen. So that really rubbed in the wound quite nicely. but other than that, I mean, you know, there are lots of amazing artists and stuff you get the time to come across, but I'm also just grateful, really. I don't try to look back, you know, like negatively on what happened or what didn't happen. You know, I'm just grateful for what we have. You know, when I look at the roster of Transgressive, past and present, I just feel really honoured to work with so many amazing people, and to also share that experience with the people that I run the company with and that work for the company. It's like, it's a privilege. You know, it's not something we take lightly. We wake up every day feeling like we're on a mission and that we've got this amazing platform and this amazing set of minds and perspectives we get to share with the world, and that's wicked. You know, the fact that, you know, we've got Mi Blanco on the same label as, you know, the late great Sophie, as we've got, you know, people like Foles and Arlo Parks and Damon Albarn, and, you know, like brand new stuff as well that we're about to announce very shortly that no one's heard of. You know, it's like, it just makes me feel super honored. You know, it's amazing. It's really, really incredible. 22 Red Pod.